we've all had our food and fuel replenished, and we're ready to continue. So our next speaker will follow nicely from Dr. Lewis' presentation, and he's been involved in some of the efforts that she referred to. Dr. James Akechukwu is a policy associate with Big Map, and he's been with us for about the last 7 or 8 months, and it's been a pleasure to have him with us. His current work focuses on the evolution of policy and regulatory frameworks in Africa for embracing genetically modified agricultural technologies, the movement of genes from cultivated sorghum to wild-related species, which, of course, is one of the concerns that is widespread in the implementation of biotechnology. And also, he's working on the development of standard genetic stocks for evaluating genetically engineered sorghum. James is on sabbatical from Moi University in Eldoret, Kenya, where he's a senior lecturer in the Department of Biotechnology. James was instrumental in raising funds to set up biotech lab capacity and initiate sorghum research on biotech sorghum at the university. James also served as the Director of Regulatory Affairs for Africa Harvest in Nairobi. And at Africa Harvest, through the Africa Biofortified Sorghum Project, James developed standard procedures for testing genetically engineered sorghum in Africa. So James has received the Research Award for Sustainable Agriculture from the Schweisfurth Foundation in Munich, and he's a member of several key professional societies in Kenya and also internationally. So get started here. Okay, well, as you can see, James' topic is improving crop productivity and food security in sub-Saharan Africa. So please join me in welcoming Dr. James Akechukwu.
Thank you, Gary. I take this opportunity to thank the organizers of this symposium for giving me a chance to share with you a little bit about crop productivity in sub-Saharan Africa and its implications on food security in the region. I'm also really privileged to give this presentation after the talk of Dr. Josette Lewis, who I've known for a little while and also had funded some of our efforts in Africa. And I think she made really exciting presentation about the situation of ag development in Africa, especially with regards to biotechnology. I'm just going to highlight a few issues as regards to Africa's food crisis and the causes of underperforming agriculture in sub-Saharan Africa, the major challenge, and also look at other measures that need to be undertaken to increase crop productivity in this region. And then have a slide or two just to talk about the Africa's biofuel potential and then draw a few conclusions. World Food Summit meeting in Rome in 1996 actually defined food security as a state where all people at all times have access to sufficient, safe, and nutritious food for an active and healthy life. And this therefore means that food security is a human right. Yet in sub-Saharan Africa, food insecurity is more prevalent with more volatile environment, more people undernourished, and depend heavily on food aid. And Africa's food crisis actually existed much before the global food crisis, and just as mentioned, because of the underperforming agriculture, and also the population growth that has actually overtaken the agricultural growth. Climate change, rising cost of food, armed conflicts, have actually just made things worse. Statistically, about one-third of sub-Saharan Africa's population suffers chronic hunger and in dire need of food aid. And over 25% of African grain needs are actually met through importation from outside. If you just look at the underperforming agriculture here and population boom in Africa, most of the regions of the world reduced their food levels in the last 10 years. But only Africa has experienced significant growth in population living under $1 a day. And this is mainly because of lagging agriculture, as I've mentioned, and it's one of the main reasons for this. As a result, Africa now produces less cereals per capita than it did in 1961, that's about 40 years ago, and has to rely on food imports. This is well illustrated in this graphic where, compared to other regions, sub-Saharan Africa actually is, its cereal production or yield actually has more or less stagnated, and that little increase actually has been because of increase in acreage moving into some of the marginal land. But as a result, the food production per capita actually is on the negative trend in sub-Saharan region. So what are these major causes of this underperforming agriculture? So a few highlights: African farmers still, most of them, and 80% of them actually depend on agriculture, and they are in the rural area. They still grow the traditional crops, the traditional varieties, the so-called land races, which actually have significantly low yield compared to the rest of the world. Now, just focus on the three major cereal staples for Africa, that is maize, sorghum, and millet. You find that the yield in sub-Saharan Africa or in Africa as a whole, actually the average compared to the world average is low, and compared to the rest of the region is actually very low. Just particularly look at corn, it's still under 2 tons an hectare, and sorghum, actually this is FAO data of 2007, this is a significant increment in sorghum here in terms of yield per hectare. It actually has been just about 600 kilogram an hectare. So this shows really that there's still room for significant improvement in terms of developing high-yielding crop varieties. Frequent droughts also have contributed significantly to food insecurity in sub-Saharan Africa. The risk of drought is the most important constraint of African agriculture, and it severely affects the most important African staple crops, like maize in the Sahel and the region, and here sorghum field in Somalia, which had not produced crop for a couple of years, and this has got really great impact on food security in Africa. Parasitic weeds, for example, there's tiger weed or the witch weed, that is how we know it in Africa, because it's like bewitches crops and especially the cereals. Striga infects about 20 to 40 million hectares of cereal farmland in sub-Saharan Africa, and yield losses could range from 20% to 80%, but can also reach 100%. And intensive monocropping and declining soil fertility aggravate the situation. Strigas are never selectively controlled by any herbicide until they emerge from the soil, which actually would be too late to control them. And there are some interventions right now trying to coat seed maize with some herbicide, which are the maize is tolerant to the herbicide. And this is one of the interventions that Africa Agricultural Technology Foundation is now trying to get into the hands of farmers, and just read the latest information that they're trying to reach now about 50,000 small-scale farmers in Western Kenya with that technology, and hopefully they will upscale it to other parts of the region. Africa also hosts a number of pests, and there are also several diseases that affect its cereal production, especially the stem borers, the grain weevils, the grain moths, and the leaf diseases. Stem boring insects, leaf diseases, for example, they cause yield loss in corn between about 10% and between 5 to 10%, and the loss due to storage pests is about 10 to 20%. In fact, the storage pests are actually not yet included in any breeding program in Africa, at least to the best of my knowledge. So there is actually some room to look for technologies that could actually help in this direction. In terms of soils and fertilizer use, I would like to say here that Africa actually has poor soils, particularly in some of the essential minerals. This is because of the exhaustion, continuous use without replenishment. And Africa's fertilizer use actually is very low compared to the rest of the world. It's averaged, excuse me. Excuse me for that. It's averaged that Africa uses about just 8 kilograms an hectare. And if you compare Africa's fertilizer use with the rest of the world, it's pretty low. FAO actually estimated that fertilizer use needs to triple in Africa to just about 23 kilograms an hectare so that Africa can meet its Millennium Development Goals by 2015. The other thing to look at is actually irrigation in Africa. Irrigation in Africa, Africa is a vast continent, actually the second largest continent in the world, but with few land water masses, few rivers actually cutting across the continent. And irrigation system in Africa is actually quite low compared to the rest of the world, as we can see there. It's estimated that 39.4 million hectares of land in Africa actually has potentiality for irrigation, but only 7.1 million hectares is currently developed under irrigation, and this leaves out a huge 32.3 million hectares that needs new irrigation. So just trying to figure out then how much actually of Hermes never feeds the family in a smallholder scale in Africa, given all these constraints that I've mentioned, that 17%, if this, these constraints are all present in a farmer's field, 17% is of the, that yield is lost to drought, 20% lost due to infertile soil, 5% lost to leaf disease, another 5% lost to ear rot, and 10% lost to stem boring insects, and 10 to 20% lost due to insects that attack stored corn, and then 15% lost due to striga weed. So the farmer is left with a very small portion, 8%, to feed the family. Now, I just want to mention a major challenge here. Many people ask me why can't technologies that have worked elsewhere, like in Latin America or Asia, work for Africa? But I think I would like to mention one major challenge here is the diverse agroecology. Agriculture in sub-Saharan Africa is very diverse, differing from that of Asia. And the Green Revolution cereals in Asia were mainly wheat and rice. But in Africa, you have really a number of staples ranging from sorghum to yams and plantains. And the smallholders in Africa are also highly diverse. And this makes adoption from outside really difficult. And this has been tried and experimented just to bring a technology that has worked elsewhere and put it to work in Africa. It has not beared much fruit. So what are the other measures that need to be taken into consideration to increase crop productivity in sub-Saharan Africa? In this picture, I'm just showing one of the flooding areas in Western Kenya. But in the previous years, like 2005, 2007, there's been flooding reports in Africa for over 17 countries, from Ethiopia to Senegal. But here in West Africa, in Western Kenya, for example, the crops, homes, schools, clinics, and are actually submerged almost every year, even this year. But I just want to show an example of where a private company came in, actually just some about 20 miles away from here, where also this is a flooding-prone area. This is a private company from the U.S., Dominion Group of Farms, came in and put up excellent facility, got lease land for 45 years and turn around everything in that area, which used to have floods. Now it produces great crop, rice, sorghum, sunflower for local markets and also for the region. This is, I know there are many other success stories like this elsewhere in Africa. I visited Mozambique in 2007, and I was just amazed how they have turned around their agriculture there, knowing the history of Mozambique. They were in war for many, many years and a lot of destruction. But it just takes simply a political will, because before when Dominion first visited Kenya in 2003, there was a lot of resistance from the people around, but because of the political will, they got a chance actually to show their technology around. Another thing I would like to mention here is improving machinery and extension services. African farmers from, from Burkina Faso to down to Malawi, most of farming is actually done by women and children, and they use traditional hoes to till the land and weed the crops. But a simple improvement in terms of ox-drawn ripened plant and even the tractor-drawn, like here seen in South Africa, can actually do a lot of help towards improving crop productivity in the region. Let me mention something a little about improving marketing and distribution systems in sub-Saharan region. At the national level, I believe that improved rural infrastructure for market access would go a long way to improve food security situation in this region. But at the international level, I think that policies need to be developed for free market to access for the products from Africa to access the world market. I also believe that African countries need technical and financial assistance, especially to do with the WTO legislation. So they need capacity building to develop necessary legislation for compliance. Some trade barriers do exist within the region and also at the international level. Some probably have negative implications, and I feel that this one should be removed. When all is said and done, let me mention about exploiting technological potential, especially agricultural biotechnology, for proper development. Few trials are being done in Africa right now to develop crop varieties that are resistant to insect and disease, and those which are drought tolerant, and also those which provide nutritional improvement. I think, and this is my personal belief, having been involved in one of the projects that is addressing some of these issues, that these technologies should actually be applied to food security crops. And some of these food security crops are actually just specific to Africa, like the cowpeas, the cassavas, the bananas, the plantains, the sorghums, the millets. And this should actually be country-specific, which have got regulatory frameworks. I would mention here that today in Africa, we have about 11 countries that have approved GM biosafety laws, but only 3 out of these 11 countries have actually commercializing GM technologies. I also would like to mention that information technology would help a long way. And I draw example from Malawi, where they are using this to connect the rural farmers with the urban market. Let me quickly say that other research processes to capture demand really include farmer participatory methods that have also been seen to work very well in Africa, empowering farmer organizations, especially in research decision making and co-financing R&D, including women in these farmer organizations, and they have a say, and I've attended a couple of conferences in Africa where women representatives of these organizations give moving testimonies of the impact of what the organizations have done in improving food security in their region. Public-private partnerships in value chains should be encouraged, and I'll just mention one where I was involved in the Africa Biofortified Sorghum Project, where public-private partnerships are involved. So the private sector donates the technology, and the public institutions do the communication and public acceptance strategy, regulatory frameworks, and also coordination and management. I know that there has been a link between the CGR and the NAS, but I think this linkage should be strengthened in Africa. Finally, I would say that increasing investment in higher education in agriculture is also would go a long way to encourage African countries to put agriculture back on the development agenda. In the 70s to the 80s, actual agriculture was such a key subject in the universities and at postgraduate levels. But beginning of 90s, most of this actually, people are students actually were not enrolling much in agriculture, because if I remember when I graduated with my bachelor's degree in agriculture in 1989 in Kenya, for example, only half of the class got employed, so the other half were left to look for job for themselves. So they only half got posting to be agricultural extension officers. That meant that the years following 1989 in Kenya, many students were shifting from enrolling in agriculture. And that actually affected staffing also in agricultural subjects. I think that if, some of the curricula in agriculture actually right now just operating in these countries are actually outdated and need to be reviewed. And some of the labs and the facilities that are engaged in agricultural research are actually deteriorated. Women representation in students' enrollment in agricultural science actually is also just about a third or less of the men folk, and extension services, actually there are also very few women involved. And we know in the background that women actually do most of agricultural work in Africa. There also has been, from the late 90s to the early 2000s, donor fatigue in funding agricultural research in Africa. But I'm very happy to say here that new donors have come up, like the Gates Foundation, the McKnight Foundation, and also the Rockefeller Foundation, which has been there for a while, are taking a new strategy to finance agricultural research and development in sub-Saharan Africa. I think I would not be very fair to you if I don't mention political instability in Africa. And I would point out, for example, the armed conflicts in DRC Congo, or in Darfur, or in, quite a number of countries in Africa, through to election disputes in Kenya with internally displaced persons, and also in Zimbabwe. Now, these have got catastrophic consequences in access to food. But the good news that I would like to point out here that African governments now are starting to share power, to share governments, and this is witnessed first in Kenya, and now also in Zimbabwe. So we hope that in future there will be less of this political instability. Just something to mention that in Kenya, for example, most of the people who were displaced, actually they were from the grain basket of the country, the Rift Valley. So that means that most farms were abandoned, and that had great significant food insecurity in that country, which they are experiencing right now. So let me mention something a little bit about Africa's biofuel potential. About 39 countries in Africa are net fuel importers, and that means 39% of total energy used in this region. A country like Kenya, for example, spent $1.5 billion in 2007 for fuel import, which actually was about 22% of its national budget that year. A Pan-African ministerial meeting in 2007 in Mozambique actually declared that the African countries need to increase research in renewable energy, and that is biofuel. And this would go a long way to harness Africa's vast biomass resources. But the debate on crops for food versus crops for fuel is the major, major problem here. A few countries are exploiting jatropha, which is a natural fence, mostly in West Africa, growing in poor soils and has more oil for this endeavor. But just to mention a few current efforts in biofuel use in Africa, for example, in Malawi, a private public research venture tested a vehicle for 1,000 kilometers on ethanol, and currently they are blending gasoline with 10% sugarcane ethanol. In Nigeria, the country is investing about $100 million to create a biofuel town near Lagos, and currently they are blending gasoline with 10% cassava ethanol. In Mozambique, ICRISAT is working with a private company called Rusni Distilleries Limited, and they are investing $30 million and hope to produce 100,000 liters of sorghum ethanol a year. In conclusion, I would say that African agriculture must be put back on development agenda, and this can be seen very well in the new Partnership for African Development, CADAP agenda, and also the Agra strategy. In this case, the African governments are agreeing to increase spending in agriculture from up to 10% of their national budget and increase agricultural production to about 6%. Currently, these countries are actually just spending 4 to 5% of their national budget in agriculture. So there's need for strong political will to encourage African governments to put more than agreed 10% of their national budget into agriculture. More investments is also needed in agricultural research and education, and especially those that are targeting smallholder sector, and private-public sector partnerships should be encouraged. New technologies, including biotechnology, should be exploited alongside existing ones. And I think reforms are needed to create fair world trading system. And finally, I would say that biofuel technologies should be developed that do not compete with food crops. Thank you.
Thank you very much, James. I think we'll hold our questions for the panel discussion and move on here. Okay. Well, our last speaker for the morning session is Monica Pequeño Araujo. She's professor of botany at the Argentine Catholic University. Dr. Araujo was born in Buenos Aires and attended the Agricultural Sciences College there, where she earned degrees in engineering of agricultural production and in agricultural sciences. She has pursued an understanding of the entire chain of food production and utilization from field to fork through studies on food technology and aquaculture in Bologna, Italy, and working with food processors and suppliers. From 1986 to 91, she worked on developing and directing several projects related to agricultural production that were financed by the World Bank and the Inter-American Bank and several of the EU governments. Monica has represented Argentina in the seed schemes planning meetings of the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development and the IOSCA Convention on Biological Diversity, as well as other biotechnology-related conferences. She's also a charter member of CONABIA, which is the National Committee on Agricultural Biotechnology in Argentina, which was created in 1991. This committee analyzes applications and makes recommendations regarding the approval of field trials for biotechnology in Argentina, and she played a key role in the formulation of the guidelines for conducting biotech field trials in Argentina, and she also trains officials who are in charge of inspecting these field trials. So her topic today is posing a question, which we'll see if she answers it for us. The question is Latin America prepared for biofuels? So please join me in welcoming Monica Pequeño Araujo.
I see. First of all, I want to thank Dr. Manjeet and Professor Wald for inviting me to make this presentation. And I want to apologize, you know, that English is not my mother language. I'll try to do my best. And if I say something you don't understand, please stop me and I'll try to explain it. Trying to prepare this presentation, I learned two things that were quite interesting for me. You know that Sir Rudolf Diesel make his engine work with peanut oil. I didn't know that. And also I learned about Henry Ford saying that all the cars in future could be propelled with ethanol. So those things were good for me. A ver. Ya, bueno. Better for me. Hasta. Bueno, here's a map of Latin America. What you know what is Latin America, but what I want to tell you that there are two kind of crops that are used nowadays to as biofuels, and both of them can be grown between the tropics. So you can put a line from Mexico and Cuba up to the north of Argentina, Paraguay, and in that area you can grow sugarcane and palm oil. In the other areas, not because of the weather. Also, it's interesting to think about that in the eastern countries, you can have petroleum, but it is not so easy to find petroleum in the western countries. So that makes a different panorama. And another thing to think about is that in some of these countries, the cars and trucks or whatever are enough old, not to support using another kind of fuel, but fossil fuels. So with this panorama, I'll try to start presenting the different countries. And in alphabetical order, I will start with Argentina. Here you have a chart that I translated from the Inter-American Institute for Cooperation on Agriculture. And here you have the a lot of crops that can be used as biofuels for biodiesel or for ethanol. And all of them can be grown in Latin America. Here's the original chart in Spanish. Bueno, what happens in Argentina? You know that in Argentina we have petroleum, but nowadays there is potent force a law by which in the year 210, 5% of biodiesel must be mixed with diesel fuel, and by the 212, 5% of ethanol must be mixed with gasoline. Mostly of the biodiesel that we get today is obtained from soybean, but sunflower could be a good possibility. Argentina is a very, it's an important producer of also sunflower oil. Nevertheless, you can get nowadays in Argentina a diesel called B100 that is produced mainly for some European cars that are, because it's approved for the European norms. But this diesel is as expensive as the best kind of gasoline you can get in Argentina that has more than 95 octanes. So it's very expensive because the price of soybean is also very high. Nevertheless, we think that we can produce biofuels also using another kind of crops. For example, jatropha. Jatropha is almost new for us, but it adapts to marginal areas. And in the west side of the country, where it's very dry areas, it's grown nowadays in complement, for example, with olive trees. And there is used to produce biodiesels. In the north part of the country, where sugar cane is grown, it was used from some years ago, ethanol mixed with gasolines. What happens with Brazil? Brazil has very good possibilities and have a story with this. It was somehow difficult in before to found petroleum in Brazil, and that's why they started using ethanol from sugarcane. See that in 1925, it was used the first car in Brazil with bioethanol. In 1979, the first commercial car using bioethanol, it was a Volkswagen, appeared in the market. And afterwards appeared the flex fuel technology that can be used with gasoline, with ethanol, or with a mix of both. Ethanol is obtained from sugarcane, and they have made a lot of studies showing the advantages of using sugarcane. There's just one problem, that for harvesting sugarcane, in some areas they burn the sugarcane before harvesting. And when they burn this sugarcane, methanol and other kind of gases are get into the atmosphere, and there's a problem. And it is in some places they refuse to use a mechanical tillage because they say that a lot of people are going to lose their jobs. But UC is one of the most interesting countries about accepting biofuels, and they also have palm oil that they are going to use as a diesel. You are going to see that here I don't have Bolivia. Bolivia is a quite interesting country, and it is also somehow a problem. Bolivia has the possibility of growing many kind of crops and using biofuels. But sometimes, you know, politics reasons don't let the country use biofuels, and they are importers of gasolines. What happens with Chile? Chile, as you see here, has 39% of the energetic matrix comes from the petroleum, but they mostly don't produce, because 97% of this petroleum is imported. Up to now, there is just a private project to produce biodiesel from a farm using oilseed rape, but this diesel is just going to be used for this farm, and it's just a private initiative. What happens with Colombia? Colombia, since 2005, all the gasoline must be oxygenated with alcohol that is provided by sugarcane industry. Palm oil is also used in a 10% with fuel oil, but to achieve their goals, you know, they need 1,000 more hectares to be planted with palms. And that's a problem, because what people is saying, they do accept to plant palms, but there are going to be all these hectares that they are going to lose to plant it or use them for other kind of crops. When in Cuba, you know that Cuba produces ethanol from sugarcane. They are exporters of ethanol. Venezuela, for example, is one of the countries that buys this ethanol. That's all what we know about it. But in Cuba, for example, biodiesel is not fully used, because cars are very old and they don't accept biodiesels. In Costa Rica, for example, since this year is going to put in force a decree that regulates the production and distribution of biofuels. It's going to be a new piece of law, but up to now, biofuels could be produced, particularly ethanol from sugarcane, but it could not be sold. So if you produce it, you can use it, but not sell it to third people. Ecuador, that has also very good possibilities, is starting to produce ethanol from sugarcane in order to reach a mix of 5% of ethanol and gasoline. And also there is a plan to increase the area sown with sugarcane and palm tree, and using also 100,000 hectares for production of biofuels. But In this country, you have also the questioning of farmers and people that they say that if they use these crops for biofuels, or they use these lands for biofuels, they are going to lose land for other kinds of crops with which they can eat. And to produce, for example, 25 gallons of ethanol from maize is needed the same quantity of maize to feed a man during 1 year. Those are the arguments they are using. What happens in Guatemala? In Guatemala, they are starting a development of biofuels with jatropha and palm oil. And they think that they are capable to satisfy the domestic demand of a 10% mix of ethanol with gasoline using sugarcane. In Honduras, they do produce some companies for their own use a biodiesel that it is 100% biodiesel, but it is not in the market for everybody. They just produce it and use it for themselves. And the decision of producing or not this biodiesel depends strictly on the price of palm oil. In Paraguay, there is a scope that in the year 2010, a 5% of biodiesel in a mixture with biofuel diesel and a 5% of ethanol must be mixed with gasoline. They have a new law put in force to achieve this, and they are planting also palm for obtaining palm oil. In Peru, it is going to be mandatory to mix a 2% of biodiesel and a 5% of ethanol. And for that, they are also planting palm. And from the area they are planting, only 40% is producing nowadays. And but they estimate that in the year 2011, Peru will satisfy the domestic needs of biofuels. Nicaragua, I put it in another color because it's another problem. Nicaragua has started some years ago an arrangement to produce biofuels. But recently, the president of Nicaragua said that he is against biofuels because if they produce biofuels now, they are going to lose hectares of land that could be used for as food. Nevertheless, Nicaragua uses 50% of the fuels they import or produce to produce energy, and the other part is destined for transportation, and nowadays is one of the most poorest countries in Latin America. Uruguay have made some studies. They are starting to produce a piece of law to regulate this, and from these studies they say that it depends on the price of corn or soybean to take a decision of using biofuels or not. They produce very little fuel, they import, and using crops, they would use just corn, sorghum, or perhaps for diesel, they would produce with soybean. Bueno, Venezuela produce petroleum, and they import from Brazil and Cuba bioethanol, and they mix an 8% with the gasoline. They have plans to increase the area planted with sugar cane to produce more ethanol as to be used as a carburant. Bueno, here's a chart. Perhaps it's somehow difficult to read it, but I think that the most important thing to know or to look when you can is which are the countries that consume more gasoline. First of all, you have there Guatemala, Mexico, obviously. You know that Mexico has an enormous population, Peru, Republica Dominicana, small island, but they use a lot of gasoline, and Venezuela. But if you go to the third big column, it's the agricultural area, you see that Guatemala has a big area, but you go downwards, and Mexico has the one of the biggest areas that can use for this. Paraguay has an interesting area, also Peru and Venezuela. You know that always the question posed by some countries is, we are going to lose an area that can used as for feed and food just to produce biofuels. That is the main question. But in all this kind of questions, something of politics is mixed all the time. And here in this other chart, you see that there are very few countries that have laws put in force that can establishing quite clear rules to be used for the production and mixing of these fuels. Those countries are Argentina, Brazil, Colombia, Costa Rica, Paraguay, and Peru. Other countries, they are studying some laws to be put in force, but you know that there are very few, as you can see here. Mm-hmm. So one of the solutions that could be offered is try to use those plants that are usually used as feed, for example, like sorghum and other plants, and the rest of sugar canes, to produce ethanol, and to try to produce diesel from other kind of crops, not soybean or sunflower. And what it's interesting is to think about the second generation alternative. In this second generation alternative, the plants that you can use, you need some years to be grown. For example, Salix populus, or for example, some kind of algae that you must try to multiply. And in the meanwhile, try to use crops that are that can give you this kind of biofuels with conventional meanings, like the jatropha, the sugar cane, and for example, other kind of oils like oilseed rape and cathamus, and also, for example, jatropha and perhaps jojoba also, why not, that they are not used, jatropha and jojoba, that they are not used as food for people. And this kind of alternative, it's going to be quite interesting. You know that the adoption of these technologies for some countries in Latin America is somehow difficult because the people that live in the rural areas, they are very poor people, and they are not used to adopt new technologies. Think that in Latin America, they live for about 525 million of inhabitants, and 128 million, they are poor people. And when we are talking about poor people, it's with less than $2 per day. And 50 million of them, they are in extreme poverty, living with less than $1 per day. And a 50% of this population lives in the rural areas. And this is happens mostly in the north of South America and in Central America. And these people, they have very strong convictions, religious convictions, and they make a mix of for example, of Catholic religion with their own ancestral religions, where they adored the sun and the earth. And they are used to grow the crops that their ancestors used to grow. So to adopt some different kind of crops in marginal areas that can be used as fuels, biofuels, is going to be somehow a difficult task, because you must explain them how they can grow these crops and the benefits they are going to get from these crops, and that this is not going to cause a prejudice in the crops they can grow as food for them. So it's somehow to educate people in all the things, and the possibility is there. They can do it. They can produce whatever it's needed. But I think that capacity building, as it says, or education, is going to be the main goal, and particularly to these people that live in rural areas, that they need this. An example I can give from my country is that before the RR soybean was approved in Argentina, there were many small producers that were condemned to disappear. Because, for example, to produce soybean, they had to use a mix of 5 different herbicides. And they were very expensive, and they were tending to disappear. And if you analyze the adoption of this kind of technology in Argentina, immediately it was accepted by farmers because it was comfortable for them, using one herbicide and using 1 or 2 applications, and that's all. So when farmers are able to see that the new technology is good for them, you are showing them that it's good, they adopt it immediately. Nowadays, in Argentina, almost more than 98% of the soybean grown is genetically modified soybean. And parallel to this, there were developed new technologies of low tillage and so on that are more friendly with the environment. So the farmers want to produce new things, but you must show them and teach them how to use them. But go to the farmers. One of the most important things that happened also in my country is that they started making these big field shows where everybody can go and they could compare things. And I remember people coming from Brazil at that moment, and they say, we want this. And I was telling them, no, you can't grow it because you have a strict law that will punish you if you do it. They said, but we want this. No, and then, you know. And I think that that would be the target, not to be the most important point. But no, this is what I wanted to tell you. I hope that I have covered your expectations, and I open to your questions. Thank you.
Okay, well, that was a great presentation on the situation in Latin America, and I'd like to invite the other speakers to come up here now and join us for the panel discussion. So they've left. Where are they? Okay, they're there. So if we have any written questions, then, or step up to the microphone. We don't need to hold off. But if there are any written questions, then we'll get somebody to collect those cards and bring them up here. So.
Is this on? Do I need to turn this on? Or
I think it's working.
Okay. Yeah, I'm Tom Reddick. I counseled United States soybean growers and corn growers. What we're finding is that European approval is a real barrier to entry, particularly in soybeans. And I know in Africa and also in Argentina, you pay a lot of attention to Europe before you plant anything. To what extent is that going to be a barrier to getting folks to adopt, say, the nifty new biotech crop in Argentina or, in your case, in Africa?
up to now, you know that the European Union is a quite important market for us. We export corn, we export soybean, and they are very important for us. And that's why we, in our country, when before the approval of a transformation event, we see first the impact in the environment. Afterwards, we see how if it is innocuous as food and feed, and afterwards we see the impact that it will have in our markets. And we are mainly exporters of products of the land, and the European Union is a very good market for us.
Okay, let me just quickly say something about the influence of Europe, of Africa, in adopting biotech technology. One thing I would really emphasize here is that any African government with a strong commitment and a strong political will to adopt biotech, actually, to me, is a strategy actually to ward off most of the influence from the NGOs that are antibiotic from Europe, for example. But that said and done, I would say that one thing which is needed in Africa that is to date I know is still lacking, and especially in public institutions in Africa, is a strong government affairs person that can articulate most of this agricultural biotechnology benefits to the policymakers. Because more often, some of the policymakers want to defend biotech application in their countries, but they're really afraid to make it public because they don't understand it so much, and they really kind of also don't want to know where the public is, so they don't want to lose the votes when it comes to election time. So I really believe that we need, and this is an appeal to private sector or donors that want to invest in ag biotechnology in Africa, really to put some funding aside to strengthen the government affairs section or even to initiate it. Thanks.
I just add, sort of in contrast to the example of Argentina, where there is a very direct link between adoption of technology and their export markets in Africa, the concerns from Europe are sort of more unfocused and less specific, in that they worry about threats sometimes coming from the private sector, that if they were to adopt biotech crops, that certain importers might not take take products from Africa, or policymakers being concerned about the trade implications. But if you actually do the analysis, the types of technologies that Africa might adopt in terms of biotechnology, be it corn or soybeans or cotton or some of the types of non-commercial crops that I talked about this morning, those are not products that Africa exports to Europe. Africa exports horticultural products, fruits, vegetables, flowers, a bit of fish and other types of products, but those are not things that are actually sensitive to adoption of biotech crops at this point, because no one's really making those technologies available. So the fear is a little bit more indirect and not substantiated by the actual trade flows from Africa to Europe.
This is a question for Dr. Lewis. If a biotech product is developed either by a private company or in public institutions, in developing countries, is it perceived differently or is it accepted more readily one way or the other?
That's a good question, and I think certainly a fair amount of the politics of biotech acceptance in the developing world had to do with anti-globalization, particularly the degree to which it was linked to multinational corporations. I think actually that probably predominated more than the fears about the actual safety. So from that perspective, yes, if technology is developed locally, it's often perceived to be owned more, both, you know, not just in the legal context, but actually in more of the perceptional context, and to have more relevance and generally to have a greater stake in the outcome. And again, sort of in our experience, we found it was very effective to be investing in development of technology locally. It may be in collaboration with advanced research institutions in the United States or Europe, both public and private, but to have local scientists and institutions involved gave them a stake in the technology. Even if they didn't do it all by themselves, they had a stake in it, and they were very much part of it. And they could become the face of that technology locally. So when they needed to go in and talk to the regulatory agencies or applications were filed, it was from that local institution, not from a foreign entity. And that definitely makes a big difference. It also serves a very important purpose in terms of giving countries hands-on experience in the technology, which is very important for understanding regulatory implementation. I mean, again, it's one thing to kind of sit and understand the principles of transgenic technology in an abstract way, but if you've had someone who was in a laboratory and understood what it was like to stick a gene into a plant, how those constructs were made and all that, it actually is very important to underpinning the science behind regulatory implementation. So it serves both kind of a political purpose as well as a very important purpose in strengthening the regulatory systems from a technical standpoint.
Any other questions? Adelaida?
Yes, thank you. To the panel, what do you think about, in the case of Africa, if you have an approval product like South Africa, or in the future Kenya, or in the future the BT cotton at commercial level, what will happen in the neighbor countries? As we have a good experience, the case of Brazil, why Brazil has adopted the GM product, and now the case of Bolivia. I believe that the case of Bolivia is because of the neighbor's country. So what do you think, what will happen in Africa, and also Monica, your experience? Thank you.
Yeah, thank you, Adelaida. That's really a tough question for me, but it's a nice and interesting question as well. It depends on how the countries around that country view it. For example, South Africa is viewed in the SADC region as a lead, actually in the entire Africa region as a lead country in some of these technologies, and also depends on its past experience and relationship that it has had with the neighboring countries. If I just give an example like Kenya, for example, Kenya is playing a leadership role in the Eastern and Central Africa, and particularly, especially in the East African region, that anything that Kenya tries to adopt, it's so easily adopted in Uganda, for example, in Tanzania, or in Rwanda. And probably, in some cases, they actually wait and see what Kenya says first. So it becomes a lot easier if there is a product that has been commercially approved in Kenya. It's a lot easier to gain approval in Uganda, for example, for that matter. South Africa, though it's a lead country in the old continent and also in the SADC region, there's some countries that are really are not forthcoming to follow the South African lead, and this could be seen in this area, that there are quite a number of technologies that are commercially being grown in South Africa, but they have not affected the neighboring countries as much. So that's the politics anyway. So,
maybe I'd just add that, you know, competition is a healthy thing, and I think seeing, you know, Kenya was, I think, a very strong leader in biotech. Seeing Uganda kind of come up behind its heels maybe provides a little bit of incentive. Burkina Faso's adoption of BT cotton you know, Mali started out in the lead and then got cold feet, and Burkina just plowed ahead. Mali all of a sudden is now reinterested in BT cotton. So I do think competition from an economic as well as kind of a being in the lead context means that when one country takes a step forward, then the others pay attention. I also think there will be a real challenge in that particularly in Africa, as in many developing countries, borders are porous. So how did Brazil finally make the decision to approve soybeans? Because it was forced to. Farmers made the choice for them. And I think the same will happen in Africa in spades, and countries will have to confront that. And hopefully they'll confront it in a positive way by taking steps to, rather than to pretend and put bans in place, rather see this as an opportunity to move forward and make some very rational decisions.
Yes, just to complete this, you know, after Argentina has approved this soybean, many farmers used to be present in these field shows and so on, and countries like Bolivia, Paraguay, and Brazil started having the problem that farmers were sowing this soybean, and it was not approved in these countries. And I remember once I was reading from a journal in Brazil that they were making a joke to the government and saying, what they were waiting to approve this soybean, because in Brazil at that time it costed 400 reales to protect from weeds the soybean, and in Argentina 40 reales. So they were saying, well, now, what you are waiting for? But at that moment, they had quite a strict piece of law in force that it was so difficult to apply that they were not able to approve the soybean up to many years afterwards. And nowadays, even in Santa Cruz de la Sierra, almost all the soybean that was sown was an RR soybean. I think that last year they approved this soybean to have it legally in the fields. Thank you.
Lloyd LePage from Pioneer Hybrid. Just a question for Dr. Lewis. Firstly, a commendation for USAID's work in support of biotechnology acceptance and other activities. Just maybe a clarification on the earmark for 2009 that seems to have disappeared completely for biotechnology. Maybe you can clarify that. And then secondly, we and you have talked about a lot of support for institutions, and we support that, but what we see as a huge lack of all the donors is support for African businesses themselves, and the value chains that go with that, and the industry organizations that go with that. It's almost, you know, the crumbs off the table that is received, including investments that we're involved with, for example, in the West Africa Seed Alliance and the nascent talks in East Africa as well. We need a lot more funding going into African businesses so that they can, in fact, partner with technology providers. Thank you.
Sure. Well, maybe I'll start out by saying agriculture in general has gotten the crumbs of the development assistance budget for the last 15 or 20 years. You know, we were spending about $1.2 billion a year in the mid-1980s on agriculture, and our budget last year before Congress provided some supplemental funding was $450 million, and those aren't inflation-adjusted dollars. So you can see how much agriculture really dropped off the agenda, and that was across the board. So I think the there were very few crumbs to be had in the agriculture sector. Specifically in biotech, it is it was the case that politics did, I guess, what I would argue was a good thing, and provided an earmark to the agency for a number of years that provided us with a pretty robust budget for support of agricultural biotechnology. And that actually has not been the case for the last 2 years, and the budget for biotech as a result has plummeted by at least half, if not a little more than half. So the domestic politics of foreign assistance funding definitely influences the types of work that we can do. That said, we've been able to maintain some core support to high-priority areas like regulatory development and certain technology development programs, but it has certainly hindered our ability to expand into other countries and to get more technologies in the pipeline. So we hope that it will return, as much as though we would ultimately like to know that there was support for ag development more broadly, and that is the case now. So as I mentioned earlier, the president has announced the commitment to request double the amount of funding for agricultural development in 2010. He'll be releasing his budget quite soon to that. We'll put that in front of Congress. And from that, there will be a very significant increased support for almost all aspects of agricultural development, with a particular emphasis on the value chain development and the role of the private sector in both investing and carrying the economic growth agenda forward. So I think you'll see a significant increase in the types of efforts that that go beyond the science and technology agenda, although we hope it will also increase the level of support for that, which is flagged under the declining budget over the last 20 years.
Any other questions for any of the speakers? Rick? Rick first, then Dean.
Rick Cruz, Iowa State. Dr. Aquino, you've indicated that there's substantial potential for irrigation increase in Africa. Irrigation is a tremendous technological tool to increase production. Although Jared Diamond states in his book that no civilization that's relied on irrigation has ever survived. What have there been measures of how substantial those water resources are that could be tapped for irrigation, how long they might last? Are they sustainable? Can they be replenished?
Wow. Good question, indeed. I wish I could have a good answer for you, but unfortunately, I may not have a good answer for you. Let me just start from the sustainability of the water reservoirs in Africa. I think that's really a good point that you have mentioned. Actually, there has been an alarm in African countries, starting from my own country, of the diminishing water reservoirs, the groundwater, the lakes, actually, because of the effect of the droughts and destruction of water catchment areas. Actually, this is really a big debate right now in my country, how to get people out of the settlement areas so that these water catchment areas can be protected. I think I would say at the moment that some of these reservoirs, water reservoirs in African countries actually are in danger of diminishing and may not sustain long-term irrigation or full-blown irrigation systems. But there are other technologies like harvesting rainwater, for example, could be some of the things that could be looked into in irrigation. So I think I would mention that. Sorry that I don't have so much to give you in your question. Thank you.
Question in in South America. Some years ago, Well, I had a good friend in Argentina that was growing biotech soybeans, and Brazil had not yet approved them at that time, although they were getting, we call it bootlegging in, selling the soybeans from Argentina into Brazil. I asked my friend if he did it. He said, oh, no, I'm really too far away to do it, but I don't believe in that anyway. But he stressed that he was too far away. Now, companies like Monsanto, Pioneer, that have spent millions of dollars developing biotechnology, were objecting, rightfully so in my opinion, that they weren't being able to get paid in South America, maybe more Brazil than Argentina. I don't read about that. I don't hear about that anymore. Has that been resolved, as far as you know? Or is it just because our news media is tired of talking about it? Our news media is quite shallow, in my opinion, along that line. When they get tired of something, they quit writing and talking about it. Are now, in as far as you know, in Brazil, Argentina, other South American countries, are the companies being paid in some manner? Are they satisfied with that issue of being paid for the technology that they've developed and obviously want to be paid for?
I will not thank you for this question. It's somehow difficult to answer. As far as I have understand, you're talking about plant property rights, no? Well, no, the main problem is with autogamous plants, cotton and soybean. You know, by the law that is in force, the seed law, it's somehow old, this law. The farmer can save his own production to sow it in the next year, and without limitations. And by that way, they can buy soybean this year, paying the royalties they have to pay, but they continue planting the same soybean for some extra years, and perhaps without paying nothing to the owner of this variety. Nowadays, many things have been done to solve this problem. There are different ways of solving it, and at the National Seed Institute, they are working on this to see how they can solve this problem so companies can be paid for the technology that they are putting in the market. This is not the same case in hybrids, no, because of this Mendelian segregation. But the problem is with soybean and cotton up to now in Argentina, that they are self-pollinated. We are working on that. The country is working on that. And for example, even in Brazil now, there is a new law put in force for seed production. And we are working in that area quite hard.
I'll just make a comment to that question. In Brazil, where we manage land, the soybeans are tested when they're sold, and they pay the fee, and it's deducted. So that's how they control the illegal. At the time of sale, every soybean is tested, and if it's GMO, there's a fee paid.
Excuse me. But the problem is that if the farmer saves part of the soybean he has harvested and planted in the next year, perhaps he's paying nothing for that. That's the problem. And in Brazil also, eh?
Yeah, well. Can I add something to that question? Excuse me. The only country that really is working very good is Bolivia, because they have actual legislation with the limit of the farm safe seed. that is very clear. The rest of the Latin American countries are trying to update the legislation because of the two intellectual property rights, the patent of the trade and the protection of the new varieties. So I think that Brazil and Argentina are in the same way, unless the cases where the owners of the technology are doing a directly contract with the farmers. That's the only case when they can collect the royalties. In the other case, they cannot collect the royalties. The 60% of soybean is farm-safe seed, so the owners of the variety cannot collect the royalties for those varieties. The same case of wheat varieties. So the problem is now in the region, they need to update all the legislation using the new protection of essential derivation. So it's the protection of the variety with the gene included in the variety. So I think it's a huge problem in the region to promote the new technologies in the region. Thank you.
So we have any other questions for the panel? Okay. Well, I've been really pleased with the level of interest and curiosity that the audience has expressed, and I'd like to thank you for your participation. That's really added a lot to the session this morning. And would you please also join me in thanking again our three speakers. So before I let you go, then I'll remind you that we're very fortunate to have a luncheon speaker today, Dr. Prabhu Pingali. He's the Deputy Director for Agricultural Development at the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation. So he'll be speaking today at the luncheon. And I don't know which room the luncheon is in, but Jeff's about to tell me.
Just outdoor left and next room down.
Okay. And also, please stick around for the afternoon session, which will focus on biotechnology-derived crops for food and fuel with an additional four speakers. So we still have a lot more to come this afternoon. So thanks again for the great session this morning, and we'll see you at lunch.